All right, how's everyone doing? Can you hear me okay? Sound good in the back? Yeah? Good? All right.
Check, check.
We're good?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is an MVP discussion. It's not my session. Dave just asked me to do the introductions because he says that I'm good at these types of things. Not quite sure why. But so we have the three-way panel. All three of us are Microsoft MVPs. We'll each introduce ourselves in a minute. But during the course of the session, so we have 45 minutes, and we'll leave some time for open Q&A. But if you do have any questions, make sure that you come to either the microphones, or we'll just repeat the question back because the session is being recorded and will be available for offline replay after the event, okay? Without that, Dave, do you want to go ahead and start off the introductions?
Sure. So my name is Dave Kula. I'm a Microsoft MVP, I think coming on my sixth year this year. And my specialty, they've rebranded us all to System Center, Cloud, and Data Center. But realistically, I'm a Hyper-V MVP. Never going to change from that.
I'm Mike. I think I'm at 7 or 8 years. I'm not sure as well. Kind of been into System Center MVP, went to Hyper-V MVP. Now I'm Cloud and Data Center MVP. They like to change the titles from time to time to make it difficult for us. I'm from the great country of beer, fries, chocolate, waffles, and diamonds. So every question on that I can answer. Anything else, we'll see.
Awesome. Well, my name is Clint Wyckoff. Unlike these guys, I'm a first-time MVP, so this is my first year, but I kind of provide a unique background on things. So I also have a really good VMware expertise. I'm a VXpert. I spent 8.5 years working for a Fortune 500 retailer here in the US, Dick's Sporting Goods, as a VMware guy. So kind of have a unique perspective. Each one of us are pretty active on Twitter, so we encourage each one of you to please follow us. But then also, we're going to be tweeting, or Crystal and Didier and some of the other folks that aren't here are going to be tweeting to the hashtag MVP Hour. That's something that we regularly do, where you can go out, ask questions. MVPs from around the world will answer those. So if you are active on Twitter, encourage you to give us a follow and a mention at the hashtag MVP Hour.
Awesome. And just to follow up on what we do with our MVP Hour, this was something that that Crystal actually started last July. And so we've been running it for a little over a year. And so MVPs from all over the world, you know, people are just interested in technology. The first thing you have to understand is you don't have to be an MVP to jump on there. It's just a great source of information. And we get on there and we're just taking questions from the field. You know, you may not feel comfortable to, you know, approach somebody and ask them a question. That's a great forum and a great place to do it. In a little over 1 year on that hashtag, we've had almost 8 million impressions now on that hashtag. And that's just the pure power of community and just, you know, getting some messaging and topics out there. And there's never a bad question that can be asked. And it's a great framework. So we try to run them about once a month or so. It's just a great way to get everybody together for about an hour. All right. So we've got our framework for this. And so the session format was Clint and I and Mike, we have a lot of questions that we get from doing sessions around the world. We do conferences all over the world. These guys travel a lot more than I do, but what we wanted to do is kind of compile that list into a top 10, and all of these questions are kind of centered around Windows Server technology, and specifically kind of Windows Server 2016. And so this is kind of what we've seen from the field. So here's our first one. All right, so question number one for us panelists is what do you guys think the adoption of Windows Server 2016 will be now that we hit GA this week? And by the way, I'm really glad that it did go GA this week because otherwise that slide, I'd have some problems with it.
Well, I think officially it was like a soft launch of it. I don't actually think it's going to be available until mid-October, right? If I'm not mistaken, I saw some emails going around via the MVP. So, you know, the adoption of Windows Server 2016, you know, just even thinking back a few years, you know, whenever Microsoft released 2012 R2, I was still an IT admin at that time. And I was really surprised how fast, at least in our environment, right, we quickly made the adoption of that kind of being the gold standard of operating systems as we started to move off of, you know, legacy 2008 R2. So, you know, once we got comfortable with it, the fact that it worked well, And, you know, there was a huge uptick in our infrastructure relatively fast. And we had really relatively minor problems, you know, some growing pains as you, you know, go through with patches and upgrade and hot fixes and things of that nature. But I think Windows Server 2016 will pretty much follow the same path there. So any, you know, once you get familiar with it, managing it, whether that be the full desktop version, the core version, or even Nano Server, that's a separate topic we'll talk about later. But I think, you know, relatively quickly it will be adopted as kind of a new, I don't want to say standard, but kind of a de facto, right?
I'm kind of going to disagree with this one. From what I see, but that's of course another region in the world, is it's not going to be that easy to switch from 2012 R2 to 2016. There's a huge amount of changes for the good, but just switching, just upgrading will make it rather difficult to implement those new features. What I do believe is that, at least I hope, and many people do confirm that, is that they now really are starting to work and have been doing that since TP3 or TP4 when it became interesting to figure out where they can use it, and it will gradually, new projects will be done in 2016. But their older infrastructure, moving it up to the new version, I think that will take some time. And with some time, I'm thinking, especially around Europe, 1 to 2 years before they actually do these projects. They still need to study it, see how the upgrade process is going to work. Are they going to do a complete new installation? Those kind of things. So I think it will take some time before we see that. Also, because, I mean, we can play with it, right? We can like it during TPs, but one of the things is, are all of my other third-party solutions that I need to work with Windows Server, are they ready for GA as well? And that is something which is not yet today. Most third-party vendors will need at least probably 30, 60, 90 days, till some even way longer before they will support it. And if you have management systems in place and workflows and whatever, and they do not support it yet, you're gonna wait until that is being supported.
No, that's a good point. I mean, how many folks in here, just by a show of hands, and please don't be shy, have those old crusty, you know, even Windows 2000 servers still sitting around running some legacy application because the vendor, you know, refuses to support it, or maybe it's some old application that's being used for some, maybe just some legacy use case, right, that just hasn't been updated. We had that, and that's a good point that you bring up. The applications is a huge part of it. So whenever we were doing the upgrades in the past, it was pretty much any net new workload, right? So if an application owner came to you and said, hey, we want to upgrade our app, well, guess what? As you upgrade that app, you're getting your operating system upgraded as well. And that was kind of the path that we took, you know, whenever I was there.
One of the biggest issues in jumping over to a new platform like 2016 for me has always been driver support from the manufacturers. And I found that that's always lagged a bit. So they'll release an initial version of that driver, or you'll have a Microsoft version of that driver that comes standard with the core operating system. But then if you want some enhanced features, those haven't typically released on the same day that the product has dropped. And those of us that went very bleeding edge, we felt a lot of pain because of that, because especially with 2012 and 2012 R2, it took sometimes upwards of a year plus to get some of those, you know, issues resolved, right? So it'll come, but it's just you've got to pace that change. All right, we'll do question two.
One final remark here is that I think it's important for us to realize is that we're going to have to push our third-party vendors now. Microsoft clearly has stated 2016, well, it's not going to be the latest version. They're probably going to do a name change one way or another, but it's going to go in a different space. It's not going to we're not going to wait for Server 2019 or 2020 or something. So third-party vendors, drivers, all of that stuff will need to get updated quickly, or as we are going to move into a faster pace as well, and we need to be ready for it. And to be honest, I think many of us are not ready for it, which is logical. We come from an entire different way of working. And now I believe it's time that we start preparing for us, but that means, you know, calling our vendors, nagging, saying they need to move, be faster as well, or even take the decision, look, if you don't follow, I mean, Microsoft is not going to wait. We are dependent on Microsoft. We might need to find another solution. And that's going to be a difficult exercise, I'm afraid, and that will take some time.
All right, so the next question, and this is kind of ambiguous, you know, but Dave, we'll leave this one for Dave since he was the one that created these questions and just showed them to us this morning. So Dave,
they're
what
not,
is...
They're not joking.
I'm not literally not joking. It was the bus ride over here from the hotel, and he's like, okay, guys, here's the questions. Are you ready? Joking on. So, Dave, what's your favorite feature of Server 2016?
I think probably my favorite feature of Windows 2016, Clint, has to be PowerShell Direct, because I love to build lab and automation scripts. And we had a chance to run a small kind of mini community event the Saturday before Ignite. So it was this Saturday. And we actually showed off how to build a complete environment from cradle to grave using PowerShell Direct. So for those of you that don't know what that feature is, typically if you wanted to use PowerShell to interface with your virtual infrastructure, you had to have network connectivity. So with PowerShell Direct, you can actually go directly over the VM bus. So what that means is you could actually disable that network adapter, and you can actually still run your PowerShell code into your VMs. It's super cool, and it's an amazing way, especially if you're standing up environments. So if you haven't checked it out, you're definitely going to want to see that one. That's my favorite one. Mike, how about you?
My favorite one would be NanoServer. The reason being not because today it will be ready for every workload. By far, it's not. It's got a few workloads that can run. We might see some more coming in the next. But it shows for me clearly which direction Microsoft is going as well, with their operating system being very small, and also that it's going to require another way of developing applications. There's no more MSI in it. So it's going to be APEX, which you probably know from Windows 10, only this is Server APEX, which has more possibility. But the only reason why it's my favorite is really it shows the direction where Microsoft is also pushing us, and it will give us, within our infrastructures, way more possibilities with less resources in the long run. Should you be using it today? I believe there's somewhere a question on NanoServer further on. I'd say, why not for a couple of smaller workloads? But at least we should get prepared for the future as well, because this could be a big game changer in your own on-premises environment to kind of, you know, compete, if I can say it like that, with cloud solutions as well, where it's a service provider or the big players there as well.
Great. So if I had to say what my favorite feature is, I'd probably, you know, the most impactful, right, from an end user perspective, I think there's a lot, especially with Hyper-V that Ben Armstrong and the PM team has really added there. But my favorite feature of everything there is the enhancements that they've made to the REFS file system, right? REFS stands for Resilient File System. It's upgraded better, more resilient file system as compared to NTFS. So how many guys in here are familiar or VMware shop? It's okay. It's not a swear word around here. We're friends. Many of you are, right? So if you, say, for instance, are virtualizing a SQL server, right, and you want to put the data on the D drive, you have to go out and thick provision that drive and eager zero it out, right? So you would log into ESX, the actual ESXi command prompt, and you'd go through there and you would eager zero that out. And you have to wait for it to write zeros to all those blocks of data. So if it's a large, massive VMDK that you're creating, that can take a long time, right? Same thing would occur in traditional, you know, if I was creating a dynamic virtual hard disk or VHDX in a Hyper-V environment, right, based on NTFS file system and even REFS in the past, right, it has to write out zeros across that entire block of that entire virtual hard disk. It takes a lot of time. One of the cool things that REFS 3.0 brings to is now the capability of doing fast clones of all those zeros out across the entire data set. So no longer do I have to wait for it to write out zeros. It essentially is just referencing those blocks of data that are already on disk, right? So it's instant fixed disk creation. And that's really cool. So that's my favorite feature. There's also things, you know, that different ISVs can do around that file system with backup and replication technologies that are out there. So there's a lot of enhancements that are being made to that specific file system. And that's my favorite feature.
So this one's a good one, because this is Mike's favorite feature.
So he wrote an entire ebook all on NanoServer. So he's like the subject matter expert. Wow.
So if you guys want, Mike's ebook is actually it's available at veeam.com, right? So if you just search for it.
Somewhere, yeah.
So if you just search for a NanoServer ebook, it's free. About probably more than 40, 50, 60 somewhere pages of awesomeness. 80 pages of awesomeness.
How many folks in here have actually tested out NanoServer? Watch videos on it. Several of you have, Didier. You know, I'm curious, you know, Mike, to call you out, what was specifically, like, what interested you about NanoServer? You're right by the mic, Mike.
All right, that's nice. Is this on?
Yep.
Okay. What interested me the most was actually the reduction number of patches that would go into it. That is really huge to be able to keep those systems up and running without having to reboot, especially with Hyper-V. Certainly like the fast boot times as well.
Right. So, Mike, maybe you want to just give a really quick overview of the Nano Server and the patches, and why would it take less patches?
So basically, Nano Server is what they call a headless server. There's no RDP to it. There's no UI at all. The only UI you have is some sort of old Linux DOS console that you know from the 80s, where there's no mouse. You actually have to work with the keyboard and F4 and F10. Some of us will still remember that. Yes, unfortunately, I'm that old. But that means no UIs, no MMCs, no graphical parts. Also means there's a really, really small footprint. In fact, a clean Nano server, just a kernel, just a running server, will be around between 500 and 600 megabytes, which is very low. It also means that your patch or your attack vector on those servers are very low, and there's way less code that has bugs that need to be fixed, that has a security risk, and so on. In 2014, Microsoft did a small study. That's when they were already developing it. And when you normally have the full GUI, you know, you need to reboot 12 times a year, which is every month patch Tuesday or Thursday, or depending on how fast you are. With Nano, they only had 4. And they even improved that process as well by taking out as much components as possible. So that is one of the things. Besides that, it also has less firewall ports open, only 21 or 22 services running, which is also a big difference. Just, you know, go to the services in Windows Server full GUI and you would be surprised. Less processes and so on. So all of that makes sure you have less patching. So that is indeed one good reason why you would want to investigate it, because how does it impact a modern data center? Well, less reboots, more uptime. It's something we like, right? But there's actually more than that. Nano server is also interesting because it's a server where you can install only what you want. My most stupid and, on the other hand, most fun example is if you deploy now Windows Server full UI, Windows Defender is in there. Do you really want that? Some of you will say, sure. Others will say, no way. But it's there. Nano server, if you want Defender, you actually have to deploy from outside a package to make sure it's in there. That means you can build your server exactly the way you want, and everything else which is in there and you don't like, it's not going to be in there, you decide, which is pretty cool. Keeping it small again, less patches, and so on and so forth. Also, it's literally designed to be moved quickly over the network. I mean, 500-600 megabytes, that's... I know some said here it's great for Hyper-V. Yes, that's probably the first use case what we're going to see in the field. But you can run it as a VM as well, which means live migration. I mean, full UI server is about 18 gigs moving over the network versus 600 megabytes. That's going to make a difference. So it's kind of a system that's ready for cloud applications, or if you kind of want to build your mini Azure yourself, because that is actually the main reason why they're building it. The only thing which I'm a little bit scared of, because I am a big fan of it, I'm a big fan of the technology, especially since they already have cool workloads, IIS, DNS, Hyper-V, scale-out file servers, and so on and so forth. More will come. That's also part of the powerful system. They can release a new workload in a package whenever they want. They don't need to release a new operating system or a huge roll-up update or whatever. It just comes in a package. What scares me is that Microsoft made a decision to only give this to customers who have software assurance. Now, I do know in the US it's a little bit less of an issue, but in Europe, software assurance isn't that big, really popular. Also, you know, US-based companies are normally huge. European are smaller in size. So I'm a bit scared that that might block their vision and the adoption today. Another great thing about us, and that's the last thing, and then I shut up, is if you think about, again, yeah, I know, 500, 600 megabyte, less resources, less memory, less CPU, yada, yada, yada. We're paying for compute resources in Azure. If you already have your operating system that has less resources and you want to deploy that in Azure, that means you're saving money on that side as well. But that does mean we need to rethink all of our application. It needs to be differently written and so on and so forth.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, this kind of goes back to the adoption. I think we could have a panel discussion just on the topic of NanoServer completely. But, you know, I think the adoption of NanoServer will be drastically less than just Windows Server in 2016 in general because of the challenges that folks are going to have to be faced with managing it, right? As Mike said, all you can do from the actual console of it is change the IP address, some firewall rules, things like that. Very simplistic interface. It's called the Emergency Management Console. You have to use Remote Server Manager. You have to use remote tools. You have to use Remote PowerShell to manage Nano. How many people even in here use Core today for anything? A couple of you guys. Everybody else deploys full desktop experience GUI, right? Yes?
Stop doing that.
You sound like Jeffrey.
I'm a Windows admin. I've been classically trained to right-click. Thank you very much.
Right-click, yeah. What do they say? If you control C, control V, you can manage Hyper-V?
That's right. It's patent pending.
Yeah, exactly.
You guys want to throw that up in the Twitterverse?
I think that's going to be the biggest challenge. You know, applications and workloads is one thing, but also getting the people that are going to manage the servers comfortable with managing something that takes a drastically different approach is going to be a challenge too.
Perfect. So I think the next thing that we're going to look at here is, you know, how is all of this evolving from on-premise into, you know, hybrid or pure cloud place. And so the next question is, how do you guys see the cloud-ready vision of Microsoft evolving in the data center or Azure? So I can take my own question. I wrote this one. So I wanted to talk a little bit about businesses starting to take an approach that they don't want to own data centers anymore. They don't want to be in the data center business. They want to take and have somebody else look after this. It doesn't fit for everyone. It doesn't fit for every organization, but I've seen some very, very large organizations that I've worked with over the past 18 months take an approach from the top down to go 100% cloud as much as they can, push everything up to Azure. Now, that's not an easy process or an easy transition, but as their infrastructure starts to age, and as we start to hit a 3 to 5 year life cycle of that gear, they've got to make a decision whether or not they want to make that capital investment again. Let's take an organization that dropped $5 million, a big company dropped $5 million on data center infrastructure 5 years ago. Well, that's a pretty big check to write again after that gear gets end of life. So it starts to become pretty interesting when we can have a hybrid infrastructure that allows us to seamlessly transition between on-prem to in the cloud, where you almost can't even tell the difference anymore between where you're running that gear. I want to scale up, no problem. I hit the button, I can scale up on demand. I don't have to wait for my admins to go, you know, rack and stack more gear. It's just there and it's available for us. And so I know that you guys in your jobs that you have, you're starting to see this a lot more with customers that you guys are talking to, right?
There's definitely a lot of interest, and we get asked questions about it all the time. And I think it's based on, you know, different from an organization and even a geographical, like, location by location. You know, there's parts of the world where there's data sovereignty problems. You know, Canada, Dave, for instance, right? There's rules up there that they don't permit any of the data to leave the boundaries of the country. You know, a lot of those same rules apply over in Europe as well. But I mean, I think there's definite use cases for public cloud. Do I see every application having a home there? No, and it's based on an environment by environment basis. But I definitely see not only just cloud infrastructure being a good play there for certain applications and workloads, but also like software-based apps. So like Salesforce.com and even like Office 365. People in here using Office 365? Yeah, many of you are. So that's a huge adoption rate there. Think of, you know, Adobe, right? You can't even install any of the Adobe bits, right? If Photoshop, Premiere, those types of applications, it's all subscription-based now. So that's kind of the way that the industry is changing from more of a perpetual, like, on-premises installation of applications and services to more of a cloud-based subscription model. But I think that the Microsoft's obviously made huge investments in there. So, you know, the infrastructure is a huge part of it, but also the platform. So the applications that you can go out in the Azure marketplace and readily deploy. You know, Mike made reference to those earlier. You know, you can go out in the Azure marketplace and deploy, you know, a SQL server literally just within a few clicks. So I think that those workloads specifically to some applications have kind of a good place there too.
If I look at it on the long term, I think Microsoft's vision is a good one. Seeing they're playing the hybrid role, although they tend to talk cloud only lately and simply server, oh yeah, it's GA. That's the only thing they kind of said yesterday. But when I talk to larger customers and people that actually tried already and came back, or some still are running there, there's still some things that are not solved. And finally, customers are start to see through the cloud marketing word, and excuse me that I call it like that, but it's really a marketing word. They start to ask questions. We did management like this. We had workflows like this. Now I'm moving to the cloud. Can I use the same workflows? Do I need to adapt something? What about my rules? What about where is my data? Can I get it back? Is it there forever? And what if I want to change provider? Because we're not only talking about Azure now anymore. We're talking about AWS. We're talking about Google. And we talk about any service provider in the country. And we finally see that people start to ask the right questions. And what we see then is that the entire circle of having that entire hybrid vision is not everywhere ready. It's ready for certain workloads, and you can start with those. But really, most companies that have already a long history and have on-premises installations and data centers for years moving entirely, I don't think there's any solution out there today that's ready. New startups can take that because they can build applications specifically for it. But the legacy, it will take another couple of years. Although I do believe that the vision is good, I don't think the technology is there completely yet.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I'm not saying that everything's going to go 100% cloud for every single customer. I think the percentage is going up very, very fast for what type of workloads we're looking to run in the cloud. So forget about everything that you've got running in your data center today. Let's look at all the new workloads that you're spinning up. Those become very easy targets to start looking at putting into the cloud. Awesome.
By the way, just a small add-on on that one. Who of you, you can be honest again, is actually scared that moving workloads in the cloud will give you less work? Not only two people, so you know the real statistics, right? It's actually going to deliver you more work. So don't be scared for your job.
Don't worry, we won't get automated out of jobs. So the next question here that we've heard a lot, because there's been, it was funny, Mike raised a very good point. Did you guys notice that in the keynote as well? That Windows Server 2016 is GA, woohoo! And then next slide. I was waiting for the balloons and fireworks, and yeah, that just kind of slid right through there. So
I personally thought the keynote was a little lackluster, to be honest. That's just my opinion.
The second half was pretty good.
It was better.
It was pretty cool. Now, when you look at moving over to Windows Server 2016, one of the big questions that we've gotten a lot from people that we've talked to in the field is upgrade paths to Windows Server 2016. And, you know, what does that upgrade path look like? Is that going to be a difficult transition? And I use the word upgrade very loosely in this slide. Because is it ever a really good idea to just pop in the next set of server media and upgrade your servers? Because in all the documentation, it says upgrade. But is that really a good idea? It might work for you, but I don't know if that's
necessarily
the best
path. Probably guaranteed to run into problems in the future.
So if you're looking for a make-work project down the road, that might be a good path. So what are the different ways that we can actually handle this from an upgrade?
Yeah, so the first is kind of play the shell game. So we talked about as an application gets upgraded, you upgrade the operating system with it because that's a great chance to take that app down, introduce a new environment where it's fully supported with the new operating system. So, you know, Dave said upgrading an operating system is never a good idea. It's considered to be an absolute not best practice to follow. So you would essentially stand up a new server, install Windows Server 2016 on that new server, and then either reinstall the application or migrate the application or whatever the vendor recommends is the methodology to move from one operating system to another operating system, right? But then what if I have a like a Hyper-V environment, Dave? What's the approach for that, for instance?
So that's a really good question. So Hyper-V and Windows Server 2016 for your failover clusters are going to support rolling upgrades for you. So let's say today you're running an existing, I'll just pick a round number here, 8-node Windows Server 2012 R2 failover cluster. And you want to now introduce some 2016 hosts into that cluster. You could add the 9th node into there, running Windows Server 2016. And as soon as you join that to your cluster, obviously you have to make sure that your networking and all that stuff is all configured, and we'll assume that all that's done. But as soon as that happens, stuff like live migration actually works. So I can start live migrating workloads back and forth between the environments. And so if you did move that over to 2016 and you weren't happy with it, you can actually just live migrate it back. And the only big thing is that once you're ready and you've transitioned out all of the old 2012 servers and you kind of evicted them from your cluster and completed your upgrade process, you have to take and upgrade the functional level of that cluster, and that's going to be a one-way street for you guys. You can't go back. There's no big staples, big red easy button to go back after that, and also the integrated services on there as well. Once those are upgraded to the next version, you can't go back. So there are ways back, but you just have to make sure that you're ready to go. Once you're ready to go and you pull the trigger, you're kind of committed at that point in time. Yep. Just
quickly, can you reintroduce a 2012 R2 server to that newly upgraded cluster?
To the 2016 cluster?
Correct.
What's that?
If you had to roll it back.
If it's still in mixed mode, Didier says.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Right. As soon as you upgrade the functional level of the cluster.
Let's face it, it's possible, it gives you a way out.
Yep.
That's basically the story of reducing the risk of upgrades.
Right.
But it's never, let's say, that you have to.
All right, so.
It gives you a way out if you want to do driver issues.
Did Didier? So guys, we've got one more question here. Yeah, go ahead.
The in-place upgrade was the way to do Windows 7 to Windows 10. How come it's not recommended for the Windows 2008 to 2016?
From the Windows 2012 R2 to 2016?
Or to 2008?
The fresh install, clean installs have always been a lot more stable with servers. So you've always been able to take and handle and manage the upgrades, but the problem is that you run into driver issues and such like that.
But you've got a bit of a mixed situation. Microsoft is actually trying to promote in-place upgrades, but they don't really want to fully commit to it. So
yeah.
This is the new model you're seeing with Windows 10. Basically, if you want the fast-wing now for testing, you're really deploying a new OS almost every week. And basically, they're trying to get into this cadence of releasing upgrades to the software where they are really interested in experimenting with this model for the server side. But of course, they know about all the issues. And it isn't as nice as it is on a client because the complexity of, like, if you're using switch embedded teaming or you're using standard teaming, there's going to be issues anyway. But they're really playing with the idea of moving in that direction. But it's kind of, there's a good side to it and there's a bad side to it, and you really have to know what you're getting into before deciding to in-place upgrade your cluster nodes. I do not do that. I reinstall them. But for standalone servers or VMs where I have an easy way to make a checkpoint and go back if things go wrong, why not? It has given us a tremendous ability to move forward and actually force ISVs and our own internal application owners to move ahead, because we have a very quick way of moving their servers to a new version. So we're out of the technology debt trap, and now they have to follow. And it's a bit of a political game inside of a company, but you have the technology and the ability to leverage in-place upgrades where it makes sense and where you have a benefit. But never think it is a good idea to do it for every workload.
Awesome. So just so you guys know, we have our very, very good friend and esteemed colleague, Didier. So he's another one of our MVPs. We would have had him up here, but we could only fit three chairs. So so we have time for one more quick question. We're just going to do one of our questions here. Oh, okay, go ahead.
Come in close, please.
Nano Server is on the CBB branch, and I know Windows Server 2016 is on long-term servicing branch. What are your thoughts about that, how Nano is on CBB?
Well, actually, perfect remark, actually. I love that one. If I would have a prize, you would get it now. No, what Didier just said, that Microsoft is experimenting with it, right? And they do want it, like what I said in the beginning, there's not going to be Server 2019, 2020 anymore. They want to have that same type of cadence that they have with Windows 10. Nano Server is the perfect example of that. That's how they engineered it, to make sure that every 3 months or whatever they decide can release a new Nano Server version, meaning new functionality. The thing that scares me on this, on the server level, is that's nice, but that means I need to follow. And that's nice if you're an administrator that has, you know, a couple of hundred servers and some VMs, but what if you're an enterprise that has really large data center? That also scares me if you think that they're going to use that same technology in Azure. What if I run workloads in Azure, but every 3 months they basically upgrade my operating system without me being able to stop it? I can postpone it for a bit, but not too long. Will my workload still work? Is nothing broken? These are big challenges, but it's where we're heading to. And Nano Server, as you say, is the perfect example of how they're doing it and would be, for me, my experimental field to see what is happening. I would, for example, start with having in my infrastructure one DNS server on Nano Server and have multiple other ones as well, of course. In case we see this cadence and it breaks something, at least I can, you know, still have some other infrastructure. And we're going to need to learn with it, and that's going to be a huge challenge.
Awesome. So we're going to do one more question that we had from the field, and then if you guys have lots of questions here, we're just going to open it up to kind of an open Q&A, ask us anything. That's how we like to do these. So this one's pretty big from what I've seen in the field. And so our sixth question that we have was, you know, how has PowerShell changed the way that you're working in your data center today? So, Clint, did you want to go first on that one?
Yeah, I mean, if I just think back to a few years ago, whenever I was, you know, an IT admin just like yourselves, VMware has its own PowerCLI commandlet set, and I was literally finding and looking for tasks that I could automate, and it was the easy stuff, right? I wasn't trying to be too advanced, like, and do anything complex. I was just trying to like automate the easy stuff, like provisioning a new data store or making a new virtual machine or making sure that none of my VMs had CD-ROMs attached to them so that I could take snapshots, right? The simple stuff, I think, is generally the easiest, right? It's easy to go out there and Google and look up and see, you know, hey, how do you do this, right? Or just use the examples switch whenever you're typing in a command, right? I think that's probably the best way to get started with PowerShell. But, you know, definitely it's something that if you're not using today, you should be looking at in your environment. Anybody in here comfortable with using PowerShell today? Use it on a regular basis, right? Start with the easy stuff, right? Get relatively advanced after that. Go out there and look and see what the scripting guys are doing on their blog. You know, what are the new commandlets that were introduced in the Windows 10 anniversary update and PowerShell 5.1 that just came out? You know, I think that's kind of the best way, but it's really interesting that there's specific things that you can't even do in the user interface any longer that you have to use PowerShell, for instance. There's things with on-prem Exchange that you can't even go in and do in the user interface. You have to use PowerShell. So I think it's interesting that they're kind of forcing you to at least become familiar with it from a Microsoft perspective.
I think I have a nice example, actually. It's an administrator on his own, unfortunately. He's got like to support 75 users, small shop in Europe, right? 20, 30 servers, something like that, some workloads on it. It took him a couple of years, worked with PowerShell, started to automate more things, all small things, saving him quite a lot of time during the week, which was good. And used that time to help the end users more with specific small questions. After a couple of months, where he almost had more time, helping more the end users, his boss came and literally said to him, so how the hell did you succeed in hiding yourself for 8-9 years pretending you're doing IT and now you suddenly decided to work and help the people within the company? So for me, it's a stupid story and we can laugh with it. That his boss was pretty serious actually about it, so that was not so good. But working with PowerShell, what did it change? It just bought me time. That's all. And the bad thing what I still see today is that when it can buy time for some people, other people still refuse to use it, and we see a mixed mode. So if you're in a company, I always suggest, look, make sure everybody knows PowerShell. If you want to use another scripting language or something, fine. Doesn't have to be PowerShell, but you know, we're at the Microsoft conference. So. But make sure you all work with it, save time, and use that time to solve real business issues instead of, you know, being somewhere in a data center hiding under cables, pretending, well, just kidding, doing other work.
Awesome. And so I got one more that I'll throw at you guys. PowerShell desired state configuration, so DSC. How do you guys see that changing the game of what it is that, you know, we do in the data center? Because now those accidental mistakes just kind of fix themselves. So Clint, what do you think about DSC? Because we were playing around in some demos that we were doing. I think it was with the technical preview one of Azure Stack, and so the Azure Stack deployment scripts were all written in PowerShell DSC, and you know, our demo that we had was pretty cool that we did at a Tech Mentor conference. I think it was in February of this year. And so basically, Clint would start the demo, and I said, well, this DSC thing, how resilient is it? What would happen if I actually went and just turned off the power on the nested VM? So I actually killed the power on the VM. I just hit off. And then I think it was at like step 71 of 100 and some doing the deployment. I turned it back on, step 71 of 100 and some on a hard power off. That was pretty cool for me to see the power of PowerShell DSC kicking in and just resuming exactly. It just knew where it was. So what did you think of that, Clint?
No, I thought that was pretty cool. It's a great way to have literally a desired configuration that either you're at. So if somebody goes and makes a change, right, it's easy to have that undone, right, by applying PowerShell desired state configuration. So it's a great way, I think, for application owners specifically. You know, maybe some app owners might have admin rights in your environment, right? So a great way to kind of maintain consistency across the infrastructure. Yeah, and we're good coming up here. We got 3 minutes left, so.
Yeah, so why don't we do a little bit of Q&A as you guys are coming up. If you have any questions at all, either fire your hand up. If you can't make it to the mic, you can shout it out and we'll repeat it. Guys, remember your evals for the sessions. It's how we make these things better. Please fill them out and let us know your feedback on these sessions, right? So that's what helps us come back here every year. So, all right, any questions? Yes, sir. So the question was, do we see rolling cluster support coming for other clusters outside of Hyper-V clusters?
So do you mean like scale-up file servers? Or when you say other hypervisors, like VMware? Yeah, I mean, you can do that today with VMware. So you can have mixed clusters running vSphere 5, 5.5, 6.0, Server 2016. So how would you run VMware on... So you said, oh.
No, there's no dependency. No. So the question was there a dependency on Hyper-V to perform the rolling upgrade? And the answer is no. It's just a core Windows role failover clustering upgrade. Yep, no, thanks.
I thought
thanks.
You meant
good
the
question.
Actual vSphere hypervisor. How do you,
yes, go ahead.
Can you say something about backing up and restoring shielded VMs, since it's obviously blocking pretty much everything, like PowerShell Direct and guest processing?
So, yeah, shielded VMs, great technology for the future, and for now as well, if you're talking about service providers and so on, there is indeed a problem saying it's got to be shielded, which means the hosts and every management solution on the host cannot touch the virtual machine. So if you have backup, replication, those kind of things on the hypervisor layer, no item level recovery, no indexing. The only thing you do is recover the entire virtual machine. If you still want item level recovery, wow, that was difficult. That means you, as the owner of that virtual machine, are going to have to install some kind of backup application inside the guest and then do it yourself. Because the entire idea of shielded VMs is that, well, the host and the administrators working on the host cannot see or touch your data. And if they would be able to do a backup and then look inside that backup to index it, it kind of misplaces the purpose, right? Will we see improvements in the future? Who knows? Today, everything is locked, but I think there could be perfectly that at some point you would be able to take a full virtual machine backup and then have some sort of process with credentials from the tenant run inside to do. But for today, I'm not aware of any of them being able to do it. We might see that in the future. I don't know.
Awesome, guys. I just want to be very respectful of everyone's time. We're at our session time here. We're going to stick around to continue answering questions. I don't think there's another session right behind us right away. So if you guys want to come up and chat with us, we're here. Thank you guys very much for your time, and we hope that you really enjoy the rest of Ignite 2016. Thanks, guys.